At a cozy art gallery on Kansas City's west side, a musician, Calvin Arsenia, sits strumming a harp, with sunlight streaming in through the window behind him. A few people sit cross-legged on the wood floor, lost in their own thoughts. This time of year, the gallery is full of altars, big altars, lovingly assembled with everything from old photos and videos to paper flowers and flags, old t-shirts, soccer cleats, objects that carry with them a little bit of someone's life. These altars are part of a long-standing tradition at the Mattie Rhodes Art Center. It's Dia de los Muertos, Kansas City style. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're going to hear the stories behind some of this year's altars in just a minute. But first, a little more about the celebration at Mattie Rhodes and what it means. We'll start with Shanith Carasa. She's a poet and short story writer originally from Mexico, and she joins us from UMKC's Spanish department. Hi, Shanith.
Buenos dias. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for the invitation.
So tell me about Day of the Dead as you remember it growing up.
Absolutely. I'm originally from Mexico, from the Gulf Coast, the state of Veracruz. And we used to put together, since I was a very little child, these wonderful ofrendas, altares de muertos. And my mother is from an indigenous community from the northern part of the state of Veracruz. And in her town, they put together this tablecloth embroidered with very brilliant colors. But in my city, since it's a city, we have less time and we do not much embroidery. So we do cut paper. And one of my aunts from my father's side, she taught me since I was a little girl to put together this papel picado or cut paper. And that's a very emotional connection for me because it's remembering through paper, also through designs, our loved deceased ones.
Can you tell me a little bit? I want to get back to the paper because mm-hmm. you teach this paper cutting technique as mm-hmm. part of your contribution to Kansas City's mm-hmm. celebration. But I'm curious to know more about the role of this event in the community that you grew up in and like the tradition as you understand it and its meaning.
Absolutely. Since I was a little girl, I was expecting Day of the Dead. So many children here in the U.S. are expecting Christmas Day. So I was just looking for Day of the Dead. And even though it starts today and then tomorrow, we are preparing for in a month in advance. So we are starting to think about the food, who are going to be honoring in our altares. And specifically with the papel picado, I usually use the signs that are related to plants or mariachis or Katrinas, which are happy skeletons. So just to celebrate this day and honor our deceased loved ones and to remember that it's not a spooky, sad day, but it's a way to honor our and remember our loved ones.
The paper cutting, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. is really especially meaningful to you. Can you describe what it looks like and, mm-hmm. and how you do it?
Absolutely. Nowadays, I use tissue paper because it's easy to handle. And it's also kind of an ephemeral art. So every time I finish my altar, I just get rid of everything. It's just a way of letting go. So I fold it. Nowadays, I do very freestyle figures. I'm not attached to any specific design. I just let my hand flow. But it's usually also all the time related to plants. And sometimes, as I said, a mariachi figure or a skeleton, yes.
Why plants?
Because this comes from an indigenous tradition. And in its origins, it was a mate paper. A mate paper is made out of the bark of a tree. And the designs were specifically about corn or cempasúchil, which is marigold, which is the plant, the flower for Day of the Dead. Cempasúchil means cempa, 400, súchil, flower, the flower of the 400 petals. And it's the representation for Day of the Dead. It's yellow. Yellow is the color of death in the Aztec tradition, not black. That came with Christianity. So that's why plants are so important. Yes.
You know, you mentioned that this paper cutting technique connects you to your grandmother. Mm-hmm. First of all, is your grandmother still with us?
No. Both of them are already somewhere else, but today they are coming back.
Yeah, I was curious if you had ever made an altar.
Mm-hmm. Yes, my grandmother's side, when we used to visit her in her indigenous community, the altar was already there. But I just saw what they were adding. For example, bread. She used to bake bread. And actually, the little basket that I have here, I put a small altar here at the station. It's the same one, but just bigger than the ones that we used to use in her home. So that's a little basket for bread that I brought from my mother's indigenous community. So I used to just add food because people came to visit. So people were bringing food and we were also giving away food. Yes.
When you created that altar, what did that feel like to you? I've never made an altar to someone. And so that's that's a feeling and an experience that I can imagine, but I don't know. I don't know what it would feel like.
The one that I just put together here for the station. Well, I wanted to share with all of you, since we were talking about Day of the Dead, just to bring a little piece of color and the parts of the altar that we always need to have. For example, the skeleton, right? Which is colorful. It's not spooky. It's colorful, cheerful. That tablecloth that I brought is from my mother's indigenous community. She didn't embroider it, but someone else did. That's the kind of tablecloth that they will use there. And then I have cut paper in the back that I put together that has a religious image. And with the arrival of Christianity, so things mingle together, and we have now also religious images. We have food, we have cempasúchil, the marigolds, of course, and then the sugar skulls, the small ones that I have there. It's I'm just excited to share with you a little piece of this tradition.
When you teach paper cutting in anticipation of Kansas City's celebration and helping people make their own altars, who comes to learn that skill, and what's your sense of why?
Well, I teach at the foreign language department, so sometimes we just get together in my classes and say, well, let's do something for Day of the Dead in case you want to go to Matty Rhodes and put together an altar. So we just start giving them the very basic techniques, how to fold the paper. Sometimes we just draw a design and then just put it on top of the fold paper, and then we just go through and cut it, yes.
How do people seem to respond to being invited to participate in this? I mean, do you get the feeling that they're Kansas City's approach to celebrating Day of the Dead is in some way unique or different?
Well, I think that each community in the U.S. has developed its own flavor, because I've seen different communities around the states. And, for example, here we have a very deep tradition of Day of the Dead, celebrating Day of the Dead. And I think it's well received. People are excited. She will talk a little bit later.
We have some other guests
exactly.
We're about to hear from.
So I think it's a expected celebration, yes. In my classes, I can see excitement from some of my students, or other students are just, okay, so I'm learning something new. And all my Latino students are very excited to see how to put together this traditional craft from Mexico, yeah.
Erica Noguera is here too, and she's one of the creative forces who's involved in this event. And Erica, what are your thoughts on that, on Kansas City's approach?
I think, like Shanna said, there's a deep tradition. I think a lot of it centers around the Matty Rhodes Center. They've been doing the altars, Jenny will talk about it, for many years now, and it's something that people expect. I think Matty Rhodes has been doing it for a long time, probably before it became a little more cachet than it is now. I think a lot of people in this current climate of trying to connect and understand multiculturalism and diversity more intentionally. It's, you know, more communities are paying attention, I would say. But there is a deep tradition. And I think one of the cool things that Mattie Rhodes does is not only make it this historical place that people that have been doing it, that recent immigrants, you know, the residents of the West Side have been coming to Mattie Rhodes for a long time, but they also reach out and invite new communities in. And I think the annual exhibit at Mattie Rhodes is a huge piece of Kansas City's tradition.
Talk to me about how you've gotten involved.
Well, I used to work at Mattie Rhodes a long time ago, so it has a deep place in my heart. But I'm actually Guatemalan, and we have a different tradition. It's not exactly this iteration, but, you know, certainly All Saints Day traditions and the reflection on past loved ones and ancestors is a deep part of who I am. So last year, my good friend and frequent collaborator, Chico Sierra, came to me and said, let's do an altar at Mattie Rhodes. And my initial response was, I'm not a visual artist. What would I do? I don't know how to build it. You know, I'm not a crafty person necessarily. And wasn't sure who I would honor either. But as I considered it more, thinking about what I might offer or add to an altar project was the community that we circulate in. And so we started talking. It was a heady political time last year before the election. And I thought, let's build a community, a living altar, an opportunity to bring our community together within this hallowed space of honoring death and create a living altar to celebrate our community of artists. And
can you explain a little bit more about what you mean by that?
Well, the concept of this living altar.
Yes.
So, you know, Day of the Dead is about honoring our ancestors and those who have passed. And this time last year felt like a very fraught time. Like I said, before the election, there was a lot of fear and unrest, but also this growing sense of solidarity and people being more intentional about connecting and about doing what they can to serve their community. Art was feeling more essential than ever before. And there was hope. You know, there was a lot of fear in the air, but also there was a lot of hope. And so it was a deep time of reflecting, I think, for the entire country, and I know for myself. And so as I thought about what I would want to honor in an altar context, it was really about this fraught moment of living, of life that we were in. And so what we did was reach out to our community of artists. It started out with music, but then expanded to poetry and some dance, and asked people to come and make an offering of their life in this space where we are asked to honor death and think about death.
Contribute a creative act or something?
Contribute a creative act, yes, exactly. People came and sang and just made an offering of the heart to honor their lives. It became a really beautiful thing. And then each person that came brought their own aspect. Our friends Andres and Arelis brought a very rooted indigenous spiritual tradition to the altar. And, you know, some people had never are involved in the music scene, but had never offered themselves in that way in such an intimate context where we didn't try very hard to cultivate an audience. We really said, you know, there may be 5 people, there may be 20 watching you, but this is really about how deep, what's your deep intention? How deeply can you connect with yourself and your offering of life every day and this gift that you have to share?
You know, it's the idea that you're talking about is really beautiful. It feels almost like, because when you think of a physical altar, there are objects that have to do with a person who is gone. And you're talking about that bringing yourself and that all of these people coming together create like a conceptual altar.
I think so. And I loved Shanna used the word ephemeral, and her tissue paper is ephemeral. And these altars go away year after year and come back. And she also talked about the color yellow and how that used to represent death. And I think that's exactly what we're talking about. It's spirit. It's collective spirit. It's your living spirit right now. It's the spirit of your ancestors that you carry with you every day. And so, you know, and actually we used the color yellow more prominently in the altar last year. I should talk about that. So in addition to inviting people to perform on this space, visual artist Chico Sierra built an altar. And we sent pictures back and forth, but he did the entire thing and found this incredible plexiglass thing to put behind it, and that participants would sign. And we asked people to also bring physical offerings last year. And there were lots of flowers and bright colors that you associate with Day of the Dead altars. So in the moments that there aren't people performing on the altar, it looks like a beautiful space, as all the altars do at Matty Rhodes. And then he also invited our friend Anna Arnott, who has a floral company called Asteroid Designs, and she did all of the flowers and refreshed the flowers throughout the month that we had these sporadic performances. And so, I don't know.
Can you talk to me about how this living altar, the combination of music and poetry and just the presence of living people to celebrate their own living community in combination with this object-based altar, how that experience compared to just, I mean, I have to assume you've been moved by a more traditional kind of altar at some point. Was the experience different?
Absolutely. And I think what's really powerful is that those two experiences are happening week by week. We go every week, you know, we have these performances each week at Matty Rhodes. And so it's allowed me to return and see some of these physical altars that, you know, there are these memories of loved ones that have passed in our community just this last year, you know, from Gilbert Guerrero, who's a mainstay of the Latino community this year. There's an altar to him who has touched so many of our lives in Kansas City's Hispanic community, to Uciel Pesina, who passed this last year, who's just graduated from high school and is a deep part of our hearts, to friends of mine whose parents have passed. There are record players, and there are cleats, and there are soccer jerseys, and there are old letters. And I don't know, somehow having this living component makes it all fit together. It's fluid. You know, life and death constantly coexist.
Stay with me through the break, okay?
Will do.
If you have made an altar in part of a Day of the Dead celebration this year or in years past, give us a call and tell us your story. 816-235-2888. We're going to get to those calls when KCUR's Central Standard returns, plus a little more about the people honored in this year's altars. We just heard about some of them. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about Day of the Dead in Kansas City this year and in years past. There's been a movement to bring more life into this annual celebration that traditionally commemorates people who have passed. And I've been speaking with poet Shanith Carassa and Erica Noguera, a community member who's been involved in Kansas City's Day of the Dead activities this year and last year. Now let's hear from Jenny Mendez, the art director at Matty Rhodes. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
Talk to me. We're going to jump into the stories of some of the people in this year's altars, but tell me a little bit about the background on Kansas City's approach to celebrating Day of the Dead.
Well, Matty Rhodes has been doing Day of the Dead for 19 years. This is our 19th year. And years before that, the idea was of Day of the Dead and the experience and the celebration Guadalupe Center had done it a few years and had done some celebration around it. But really, in beyond that, the West Side community, and then a little beyond that, Kansas City community, had not really celebrated it. It was kind of the unknown. And I remember painting a mural years ago. And I had, along with my mentor, Leanne Perez, had, as a high school student and then going into like college, into art school, and we were doing a mural together, and we were using Dia de los Muertos figures from Jose Posada, Guadalupe Posada, and people thought it was something really crazy that we were using these skeletal images from Day of the Dead and that were very popularized already, but not so much in Kansas City. And so to kind of educate people, we had to say, hey, this is what it is about. It's a celebration of life and death, and it's really honoring and remembering our loved ones that have passed, and it's not anything scary. Look at the skeletons again. You know, they're not doing anything crazy or scary or bloody or whatever, gruesome. And so people started listening. And then we put the mural up, and the mural has since been gone now, but it was one of those first educational moments, which is really important in what the Day of the Dead in Kansas City is today. So the Guadalupe Center's continuous, celebrations. And then once Maddie Rhodes opened up our gallery, because we were doing lots of art classes and saw that there was a need and there was a want. People wanted to know more about what this celebration was about. So we started thinking we needed to open up a space. Our first year, 19 years ago, the first exhibit that we did was our Dia de los Muertos. And we had about 10 altars and 10 amazing artists that put together some really great, very personal, intimate altars that reflected on a lot of different loved ones, issues going around, school groups that wanted to remember loved ones. It's been something amazing and really, really great to be a part of through the years.
Tell me a little bit about some of the stories that you can, I don't know, the stories being told through altars in the Art Center this year. Can we start about hearing about the altar to Usiel Piscina?
Yes.
Or Usielito, as his name appears on the athletic jerseys?
Yes. He's a young man that passed away last year, actually, around this time. And I remember just hearing the news. So it wasn't something that just hit me, but to hit so many people in the community. So when going to his funeral service and standing in the line for hours, when I finally got to reach, because he was loved by so many, finally got to reach his dad, who we've collaborated with before, and he's done many of our Day of the Dead celebrations as a musician and as a sound person and his team and just as an artist through the years. He grabbed me and he said, Jenny, you got to save the biggest spot for us for next year's Day of the Dead. And I was just like, oh, yeah. You know, like, it was like when somebody kind of hits you in the face with something when you're not expecting it. And even though that was like the perfect thing for him to say in such an imperfect time.
Yeah.
And so I saved the spot. I knew exactly where we wanted to put his altar and called him up a few weeks prior to set up. And I said, I just want to remind you, are you guys comfortable? Is this something that you'd like to do? And he said, let me get with the family. And sure enough, it was a family event for them to all. And a lot of the altars through the years have been like that, which is a beautiful experience to see when family members come in and they all contribute in some way. An aunt may bring one thing and a sister or brother brings something else, a grandfather or grandmother bring something, that you haven't seen in a long time. So that's exactly what happened with this particular family, the Melgosa Piscina family. And they put together a beautiful memorial for
a very accomplished young man.
Yes, he was a graduate of Lincoln College Prep in 2016 and was a Eagle Scout, played soccer. And I talk about him to all the students that come into our gallery. Some days I get choked up and some days, it's just that whole idea of celebrating his life. And they did such an amazing job. So it's a painted picture, really, in this altar and in a lot of the altars that really show who these people are and their life experiences.
What are some of the objects in Usiel Piscina's altar?
Well, his soccer cleats to his soccer jerseys, his army uniform, because he went into the army right after graduating high school, to awards and, you know, different things of items like his, there's some clippers, some hair clippers, because he was a very stylish young man and always had his hair crispy and clean, you know, cut. And then he has some really cool shoes because he had a lot of really nice tennis shoes. And one is in a box, in a you know, plastic box that you can see but don't touch, you know, that kind of thing. And he's just, and so to see those little things, because every time I go up, you know, you kind of see something different and new. But, you know, there's a lot of, you know, his drum set. He was a musician and a drummer. His congas that are signed by lots of different loved ones that after his passing. And there's a book that's opened up and people can leave a note to him, to some bracelets that talk about Do It For Uzi, and it it's all about suicide prevention. And so the idea of keeping his life and his memory alive, but also the message that, you know, don't feel hopeless and make sure that there's always going to be somewhere for you to go. And there's a hotline number for suicide. And the family has put out hundreds of these little rubber bracelets that yesterday we had a group that came in and from Staley High School. And I told all the kids, I said, there's enough for each one of you. And there was a group of like 77 students for each one of you to take one if you'd like. And that's what his dad said. His dad said, these are hot commodities. I need to bring you guys some more down. And he brought some down last week. So these are all things that are very important to the family that reflect on who their son was and how much love that he had, and being able to share that with other people, even though it's such a tragedy at the same time. This particular altar hits the heart of so many people, and you know, just is exactly why we do it.
There's something about, I mean, when you talked about the hair clippers and then mm-hmm. garments, shoes and jerseys, there's something about the things that were on a person's body mm-hmm. that are so intimate, and that people who knew him, I'm sure, can picture him in all of these things. They kind of bring him to life in their minds, but also people who didn't know him. I mean, just the size of a shirt and the size of the shoes, and that this touched a person's foot. There's something so intimate about that that's really different from seeing a photograph, which perfectly captures a person's likeness, but doesn't have quite the same intimacy.
Mm-hmm. Can I interject? Part of what's really powerful about the Matty Rhodes setup is that it does bring people back to this space again and again. And I think that's what's been fun about our collaboration is that, you know, Matty Rhodes always produces sort of the bookend beginning of the month and end of the month events that invites the entire community, and hundreds of people come out to see these altars. But being there week after week has been amazing. And so experiencing what you're saying, these artifacts, and also the family has come in to several of the events. And so this space is really this living community space that people are experiencing memory and death and life together.
Yeah. Jenny, will you tell us about someone else who's depicted in one of these altars, who's honored? I'm interested in hearing more about the altar to Gil Guerrero.
Sure. Well, Gil, just like a lot of community leaders, you know, here in Kansas City, you know, they put a stamp on so many people's lives, you know, and really, really have served as mentor. And, you know, when I think of Gil, I think of just that I sat on a panel many years ago with him, and the very first time I've been on many panels with him, but for Day of the Dead, and Day of the Dead was one of his loves. He could speak on the traditions and history and the way he could about anything, you know, as far as Latino or Chicano history. And so, but Day of the Dead was something really special for him. And for me to sit next to him, I forget what show it was. It was years and years ago, but we were on some particular show and talking about Day of the Dead, and it was an honor to be able to sit next to him. And I talk more about my own personal experience with going to Mexico and seeing Day of the Dead and through my art and things like that. And he was talking on the history and tradition. So to have him as part of an altar in our space, you know, I make sure to always speak on him, whether, you know, I have to skip over some altars sometimes and I have to when I'm given a tour. And just because it meant a lot for his wife to come to us, his son and his daughter, to be able to create this altar that was personal. When we talk about these items that people have and are on the altars.
What are some in his? I mean, what are some of the items?
It's one thing that hits me right when it's thinking about it. There's a shirt that's kind of like a Hawaiian cut shirt, which he wore a lot. But it has a Day of the Dead print on it with skeletons, and it's really colorful. And it sits on a chair that his wife made sure to set next to the altar, and, you know, as if he was sitting there. And a calavera skull that's sitting on the chair and is with it. And other things just include, like, just books of history, you know, Latino arts and culture history.
His books.
Yeah, his books, his personal things. And that's what's really important, is like I always make sure to let families know that a lot of times a piece of your loved one is here with us, and we're going to take wonderful care of it. We're going to make sure, you know, that we're going to do it what we can. And I think that's that they feel that from the energy that's in our space. And so they know. And I love when people come in, just like Gilbert's wife or even UCL's family, like his dad, where they come in and they bring new stuff and they refresh things and they feel very much connected to it. So those personal items are really what would help them to have that connection, that deeper connection, for not just them, but for others.
There is an altar to someone who is not Latina, and that's not uncommon. That happens as part of this community celebration. But a prominent member of our community also, Jen Maloney.
Yes. Executive chef at the Kemper. It's about Cafe Sebastian, and her family members or friends actually wanted to put together an altar. And when we did a little like a mandatory type of meeting to see who all was interested, and they came and they talked about wanting to put together this altar, and they said, I didn't really know who they were talking about yet, they were just kind of giving us a brief overview, and they said she had a love of Mexico and of particularly the state of Oaxaca, which happens to be one of my favorite places to visit. So it was great to see that, not knowing her personally, but finding more about her, and which we do a lot, and so many of the different people that come in. So it was nice to hear what they had to say about her, and have her a lot of very much personal items on the altar, from her shoes to her folk art that she collected to items that she used in her cooking that were important, you know, and or they symbolized the things that she used. Some of them were for real stuff, and then others were just put there to show. So it's great to see all different people involved in what we do and how important that is.
Jenny Mendez with us from the Maddie Rhodes Art Center. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we've also been talking with Erica Noguera and Shannon Carassa. Thank you both for being here as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Shannon's got a Writer's Place event for Day of the Dead on November 3rd.
At 7 p.m.
At 7 p.m. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we'll talk about the ministry of a spoken word poet after the break. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and our next guest is a poet with a ministry, which I mean both literally and figuratively. She's an ordained minister and a spoken word poet with a strong sense of purpose. In fact, Purpose is her middle name. Sherry Purpose Hall, hello. Thanks
hello.
For being here.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to talk to you about your personal story, but first, you have a book that came out in February called Black Girl Shattered. Tell me about the title.
So, Black Girl Shattered, I became enamored with a certain art form called kintsugi, which is an art by Japanese, and it specializes when a piece of pottery gets broken. Here we use clear glue to, you know, kind of glue it back together and act like the break
nothing didn't happen.
Nothing happened. It's pretty. It's pristine. However, in Japan, kintsugi, they will take an expensive epoxy mixed with gold dust or platinum dust and glue it back together. And what results is a brand new piece of art that is worth more than what it was worth before. And the cracks in it are outlined in gold, and it tells the story of the piece. And women are this. Women
are kintsugi. Women are this.
Yes, because when we hide our cracks, we devalue ourselves. Let's tell the true story. Let's shed some light on it. And our experiences are what make us worthy and what make us useful.
You write about this in the introduction to your book. And there's a line from that introduction. After you talk about the Japanese art form you just described, you write, "We make art out of damage." That's a really complicated statement.
Because we do. Poets are professionals at being hurt and making art out of it. People, you know, yeah, it's great to hear the flower poems, but especially when people come to hear spoken word, there's a certain aesthetic. They want to hear the damage, and they want to hear someone who can make art out of damage. The problem is sometimes it's hard to stay standing after making art out of all that damage. So that's where the ministry comes in.
Yeah, you write that this is a collection of poems, epistles, and essays. What are epistles?
So epistles, if you think about our dear friend Paul the Apostle, and look in the Bible, he wrote 13 letters. And those letters, if you look in, let's say, an old school Bible, it'll say 13 epistles. Epistles is just a fancy word for letters because poets use words that we could use other simpler words for, but whatever. So you learned something today. Epistles are pretty much letters.
So I want you to start by, there's an epistle that starts this book, and it's called Dear Life. Will you read that for us?
Absolutely. Dear Life, I think I am supposed to be gritty like sand in order to survive you. I think I'm supposed to be the kind of thing that can smooth edges yet be put through the fire and made into something transparent and easily broken. I think I'm supposed to be the type of thing that when easily broken has the ability to cut and draw blood, yet you seem to want me to possess sand while being timeless. Like a faulty hourglass spilling its contents, spreading itself way too thin across an unforgiving, restless sea somehow. You want me to stick around and just sink in, be unseen and unheard, but functional. Maybe I am full of myself. At any rate, it doesn't change what you require, and your requirements don't change my composition. I can only be who I am. I can either refine, be refined, or harm. Choose who you want me to be. Signed, Every Woman. P.S. Choose wisely.
I mean, that is amazing. But can you, your command of language, I want to hear a little bit about your relationship with language. Who inspires you? What inspires you?
Language is beautiful. I am a linguophile. And the thing is, what inspired me is when I was little, as an African-American woman, as a Black woman, actually, my aunt was a kindergarten teacher. All of my family worked in the school district, and she came and she sat with me and she taught, and I always read, and my mother had me read, and I spoke so proper. People would ask my mother who was the white little girl answering the phone. And I look back at that and am taken aback and sometimes often angry at it. Like, why in my own skin am I not accepted to be able to speak properly? However, from that, I learned growing up, there is, because my mother wasn't having ain't none of this. She ain't having ain't none of this. She is going to have this. However, my friends, we could be all like this. You know, so understanding when and where I can talk like what and to whom and what is acceptable kind of sparked that creativity, sometimes even to make our language understandable to other people in places that necessarily were not supposed to be heard like that.
In Black Girl Shattered, you tell a story about an encounter with a white woman at a Royals game.
Oh, God. August 11th, 2016. I tell two sides to that story.
Yeah, the real version and the imagined one.
Yes. And August 11th, 2016. So we weren't at the Royals game. I was actually at 7-Eleven. And it was before the Royals game. And what actually happened is, you know, it's okay to say, hey, your hair is cute. But she came up to me with her eyes all big, and I'm embarrassed, right? Because I think, oh, my God, this is a PTA mom. I don't know. I can't remember her name. Who is this? And she's like, oh, hi. And then she went straight into my head to the scalp. It's one thing like, oh, your hair is cute. You twirl the end. That's one thing. But she went straight to the scalp.
With her fingers.
With her fingers. And I felt so violated. But all I could do, I still had the same stupid, embarrassed grin. And I just froze.
Because you were smiling, thinking that this is someone you should know because of the way she was approaching you.
Right. And I was just caught off guard. And I tell people all the time, like, maybe I was just too happy. You know, we had saved these Royals tickets. They were a surprise to the kids. It was the first day of school. They had half day. We had saved this, held the secret for 3 months. I'd bought them new Royal shirts, and I just went in to get some snacks, and she approached me. So from that, I was finally able to write about it because consent does go both ways. It's not just, you know, we often talk about consent in the sexual space, and consent is also applied to just human interaction. You never know where a person is in their head, in their heart, in their mind, what may trigger them. And I just felt so embarrassed. So in my imaginary exploit of it, I didn't want to, oh, I'm going to crush your head. You know, I didn't want to be that.
Yeah, this is not a... like
revenge.
Yeah, revenge fantasy.
No, it's more of I've turned into a superhero and this has become a supervillain and my head has sprouted snakes and you know, just ridiculousness, because as a writer, feel free to be ridiculous. Rewrite your history and be ridiculous about the situation.
You are also an ordained minister, as I've mentioned, and Your formal entry into poetry was fairly recent, but it sounds like you've been working with language for a long time, whether mm-hmm. as a minister or otherwise. How does the idea of ministry fit in with what you're doing as a poet?
On the surface, it doesn't, because when I am out beyond the four walls, a lot of times I use the language of the common person or the language of the streets. So it's not
beyond the four walls of the church.
Beyond the four walls of the church. So it's not thus and thou. And as a matter of fact, it can get foul. And I meet people exactly where they are. And there is the ministry. The relationship is the ministry. The fellowship is the ministry. I don't have to work hard to Bible bash people over the head for anything. I can be the living example of Christ by just simply giving someone a hug, listening, sharing my story in the language that I use in my head rather than censoring myself. Of course, everything is done in decency and order, and there's a time and place for everything. So some of the poems that I would say out here would not be poems that I would say in there. However, I know my audiences appreciate my honesty and transparency, and that's what I'm going for. Not to be offensive, not to shock people, but my honesty and transparency is the ministry itself.
Can you talk about what inspired your first foray into spoken word? Because that sounds... if I understand it right, that's how the whole like poetry thing really started taking off for you.
It did. You know, I had toyed around with open mics before, like in 2004, 2002. I was a Deaf Poetry Jam groupie. I had to have it, had to watch it. I had always been writing since I was seven. But it was the year anniversary of the murder of the father of my two girls. Now I have four children, but it was the year anniversary and me and my best friend were out and she was like, whatever, you know, we can do whatever. And I had the choice at that time. I was 2 weeks in back to rededicating my life at church. And I had the choice to whether go do like we normally would do, which is get a couple of gallons, some blacks and go sit at the gravesite. Or I had this flyer for this poetry thing. I chose the poetry thing to go to. And never came out. just pretty much went in there. And so poetry and art, I owe art a lot, and I thank God for bringing it to me, because art has literally been catharsis for me every time. It has helped me to reemerge and start a new life every time after death.
You know, you talked at the very beginning of our conversation about this Japanese art that takes broken pieces and instead of fusing them back together invisibly as though nothing happened, to sort of embellish the places where the cracks mm-hmm. existed and draw attention to that and really celebrate it. But you've mentioned also that it's hard to stay standing after all of that.
It is.
It sounds like, you know, you've had plenty of struggle.
Yeah, yeah. There's been struggle. And, you know, for people who don't know what they're going to write about next, you know, we simply tell them, keep living. Keep living. Just keep living. You'll find something, I'm sure. And not to say that all the writing has to be about the struggle, because I write about beautiful things, uplifting things. But to appreciate all of the joy, you know, everything that makes those joyful poems and those uplifting things uplifting. I've gone through something to get there. Everybody wants the anointing, but nobody wants the journey that gets you there. And once you get on the journey, it's like, oh God, look, just keep on pushing through, keep on pushing through. And when you share your damage, when you talk about that, there should be someone there waiting in the wings to catch you if you have to let yourself down. And it is a hard job to expose yourself regularly. But honestly, if I am exposing myself, there's a reason and a purpose for it. And I've been blessed enough and fortunate enough to be able to have people, after I've really done some of more of my revealing art, to come up and talk to me afterward, like, hey, that hit me right where I needed. That was what, thank you for being so honest. You know, it's really been ground shaking for me.
Can you tell? I mean, the title of your book being Black Girl Shattered, you're telling your own stories, but between the title and your introduction, it sounds like you're also trying to speak to and about a larger community. Mm-hmm. And there's a poem in here called Mystique. And I feel like that poem is also where you are kind of doing that more directly. Mm-hmm. It's not just about you. It's about a larger community of Black women.
It is. And Black women are often shattered and broken, and we honestly aren't allowed to have emotions. We aren't allowed to break down. We aren't allowed to, hey, you know, something just happened that cracked our sternum. Can we just be for a minute and be able to recollect ourselves and heal? We are not allowed to do that because we carry the world on our backs. We're oftentimes carrying the church, we're carrying our families, we're carrying a lot. And not to say that the Black man does not exist, but in this time, we have become the crucial component, and we're not allowed to break down because everyone is pulling from us.
You're right. She is responsibility.
She is responsibility. And in that advent, I think that also speaks to a larger audience, not just the Black woman, but women in general. Like, especially, you know, people diminish the job of the housewife. Like, oh, she's just a housewife. She gets to be at home. No, she gets to take the kids to and fro and fix and do and mend and chore and this and that and the other and balance, and has to worry about everybody else's sickness before she worries about her own. You know, and if something is not in check or not done or not completed or not where it should be, she's the blame. So really, in essence, being a woman is responsibility.
That poem starts with the line, she's the question mark at the end of your sentences. And I feel like, you know, the idea of a question mark, even just when you talk about women and voices going up at the end, that's often a criticism. What do you mean by the question mark?
Often at the end of the sentence starts with, where's your mother? Where is she? Who is she? Why isn't this? Why is this? And the question mark often ends at a woman.
back to responsibility.
Back to the woman.
Well, Sherry Purpose Hall, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
We just spoke with Sherry about her new book, her newish book, Black Girl Shattered, and you can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's also where you can go back and hear stories from Day of the Dead altars on Kansas City's west side. We talked about those earlier in the show. Tomorrow, what is a championship tree? You will find out at 10. The show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tud Hope, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next.